Just a, shut the fuck up, Donnie. It's
well, just to show how it is a white man's world, you got Don Draper, who loses everything. His family, his name, all his possessions, right? And as a white man, he can start over from scratch and be completely successful, completely adored, and, you know, have everything he really wants. That waitress at the end is sort of the picture of what happens if a woman loses everything, loses her family, loses her name, her reputation. For her to go and start over is impossible. Because sexism, and that's such a huge part of the show.
You know, big the whole time.
You could argue that it's the whole thing.
It's all about the way it used to be, but everyone knows it's still the same way. It just doesn't look that way.
Well, I think that's what Will was commenting with his idea that it's just futility, that there's this idea of progress, and that we are better now. But I don't know. I don't know if I agree.
I think that there's something to be said for the way that everything gets what's being pushed upon us in terms of what our stances are. I think the stance generally of what the public actually is much different than the way that that gets represented through our media and pop culture. It could be argued that we're, you know, kind of, like that's the social engineering side of it. This is a representation of the past that, I mean, for a generation of people that never experienced it in real time, it's giving it to us in real time, but it's still like an advertisement for it. Like the whole show feels like an advertisement. Like the writers themselves are like doing a play on what they themselves are doing by doing a show about the advertising industry. It's because it's all an advertisement. And that's the bit that it seems like it's trying to force people to reflect on the degree to which that's true.
So do you think the people going through the 60s had any sense of the momentous quality of the times they were living? And then would we experience the same thing? Let's say 2000 to 2010 was equivalent to the 60s, and we had no idea. We were just living our lives.
Well,
I do think that actually, if you – the difference – and I think we're a part of it. The difference of what, I mean, after September 11th, and I would say also, you know, when I think of September 11th, I always think of the stolen election of 2000 and September 11th as being, you know, there's a cognitive dissonance that everyone is having to get on board with, whether they want to or not. That happens there, that is, you know, that everything after is so significantly different, except us. Like, we're still 20th century, you know, people, minds, trying to live in this, you know, cognitively dissonant 21st century world that's being manufactured around us. And a show like Mad Men, I think one of the reasons it's so successful is because it's documenting that kind of a shift out of, you know, it, and putting it in our parents' lives or grandparents, as some of us, but that shift, yeah, from 2001 to 2000, you know, from 2000 to 2000 to 2010, I think is huge. And if you just look at, if you were to document it, how much change technologically, socially, culturally, just in terms of everything in life, in American life, let's just say, because that's all I know, it would be like that, you know. Maybe the fashions wouldn't be as cool.
I want to know something. I want to know if Mr. Hilton was actually obsessed with the moon in the way that they present it. Because that's, like, from a synchronicity place, that's fucking weird. Because, first of all, you know, you're looking at Madison Avenue or whatever, but, like, we're, you know, like, the monolith Hilton showing up in 2001 when Haywood Floyd is walking down the corridor, this whole thing, it's first of all, the Millennium Hilton, 2001, Stanley Kubrick dies 666 days before January 1st, 2001, all of that shit, but, like, he's, like, insistent that the moon be incorporated into the advertising for the Hilton, the monolith is dug up on the moon in 2001. You know, and then I'm equating this whole thing with the Moonchild, which is what 2001 is about. And so, you guys, you follow what I'm saying? Like, it's kind of weird, but what the fuck
100%.
Is up with Mr. Hilton being obsessed with the moon? Like, well, they really make it a point.
There's one thing I just wanted to throw out is about Aquarius, is that one of the characters who was the initiator of all of the badness, that the chain of events, the sort of Coen Brothers style chain of events that leads to Charles Manson, is a guy named Hal.
There you go.
The hell out of here.
So why did he cut his nipple off again? That's how they were, what?
Because it was broken. Well, milk was coming out.
Well, and also, I mean, he was set up as this, he was, remember the, I mean, the episode that really, I mean, that character really spoke to me. Obviously, he's telling the Jewish story, and that time when he talks about how he's an alien, but, because if he wasn't an alien, then he'd have to believe that he was born in a concentration camp. And, you know, he's mad. Like, the show's called Mad Men. So, like, that guy is a madman from the get-go. In a way that, you know, all of them, in a way, I don't know, for me, that it resonates so intense. Why does he do that? I mean, why does he, because he's trying to figure out if he's an alien or if he's a kid who was born in a concentration camp. Yeah.
Born in a concentration camp and then he goes to see 2001 A Space Odyssey on acid like everyone did at the time, and then he comes to work and he sees this IBM computer, and on some subliminal level he knows that IBM and HAL are each one letter removed, and so he's just like, he doesn't know how to process it or what to do with it, and so it just comes out by him cutting off his nipple. It's as simple as that, huh?
But he represents the person coming to terms with waking up in the Black Iron Prison.
Well, IBM killed everybody with the fucking Holocaust. Were the people
right.
who...
He was born in a concentration camp. He was born in a place that was designed to kill him. When he goes to see 2001, he realizes that he's living in a city that's designed to kill him. He's in the Black Iron Prison. So he goes to the Gnostic Revelation, and he can't handle it.
It's true. It's totally, like, that is a correlation that's extremely uncanny. I forgot about the concentration camp aspect. Because if you tie that into it, and then he's freaking out over the IBM computer, come on. And then they went to go see 2001. That's
trouble.
Pretty. And then Hal kills the whole crew off. As you know, like wow, yeah, that's some trippy shit. And then the alien thing. I mean, when you block the Kleefelder, literally referred to as aliens. So, and then this is like, you know, there's a whole fear factor for people who are living in a certain context, and like the outside ones would get attributed to like people who are outsiders or whatever, you know. Fear of the other, which is really what the Kleefelder are in the first place. Like, it's a paradox because it's like on a certain level, not ultimately, but like if you're saying, oh well, if you're afraid of your neighbor, that fear of your neighbor itself is the Kleefelder aspect, not the neighbor. So there's, you know, something interesting to be said there. Fear of aliens, and then you have this whole deal with the fucking the Babylon episode. Like I was saying, you know. That's this Israeli trying to create PR for the state of Israel. Meanwhile, you know, there you go, afraid of their neighbors, you know. There's definitely something to be said for all of that there.
You want a personal, an interesting personal sink you may find interesting. I'm going to have to jump off this call in a few minutes.
Oh,
and it's well. I thought that I was. This call was from 9 to 11. I figured, you know, for
right.
all reasons. And you may find it funny that the reason I'm going to have to go is that a friend who is a woman who I work with, who is also a big fan of Mad Men and watched a lot of it, is going to be bringing me a 6 deviled eggs, which I think has. I thought you might have some. Fun, like I've never had a deviled egg date before in my life, not that it's a date, but, you know, a plan to just have deviled eggs with someone.
Should put some deviled pepper on those deviled eggs.
Yeah, boom. Absolutely. But in the context of this conversation, I can't, you know, I'm struck with the way, and I think this is the sync aspect of a show like Mad Men, is that because it was sort of in real time, we got to actually live it and then have all these crazy synchronicities around it in our own life.
Agreed.
Concur. You know?
Anyway, so if I have to jump, it's because deviled eggs are knocking.
And when all right, well, if you got to jump, go ahead and jump.
Well, I will. When the deviled eggs arrive, I'm out of here. But in the meantime, right. Let's continue.
In the golden meantime, let's...
So Ken Cosgrove, right, he's a sci-fi writer. And mm-hmm. he's the guy who loses his eye.
Yeah.
Right? And I always thought that he was gets, like an allusion to the Three Sigmata of Palmer Eldritch, because it's just such a bizarre accident, and they just work it in the show, and then he has an eye patch, and they just go with it. I thought there were some nice, because there's so many allusions to Philip K. Dick throughout the show that I just felt that that was a pretty strong echo right there.
Mm-hmm. I could see that. I love your Marshall McLuhan thing that you were pointing out, because that's totally true.
Oh,
throughout the whole film, yeah.
So Sterling Cooper at the end, right? So McLuhan's whole thing is about technology being extensions of man, and he says that when one technology is superseded by another, it's swallowed up, right? So like Windows 3.0 is swallowed up by 4.0. Like all the code, essentially 3.0, is in 4.0, but it's more refined, it's updated, and it's new. So they even say, they show them getting swallowed up, their little agency, by McCann Erickson, right? And I think that that's, what is that? That's like the swallowing of the Eucharist, right? You think that the enemy has defeated you, it's swallowed you, but, you know, it's the body of Christ. It enters into McCann Erickson, and to some extent, the message that is ejected out of McCann Erickson is the exact opposite of the portrayal of the dinosaurs who run McCann Erickson.
Right.
Actually, they hate people of a different color. They hate women having equality. They hate homosexuals and transgenders and blacks and Mexicans. They hate the whole rainbow of colors. But so they swallow up Don Draper's company, but somehow this transformation happens. You know, this message comes through. It still might be corrupted with the whole notion of poison and sugar and diabetes, but hey, you know, you got to start somewhere. But yeah, McLuhan, all over that.
Yeah.
Well, it's so funny if you think of that commercial, the Coke commercial, as sort of you're talking about the death. If at the beginning of the show, Don is struggling with the idea that he's selling the death wish to people, and by the end of the show, he realizes that that's what he's doing. Then, you know, if you think of that commercial, the Coke commercial, in terms of, like you're saying, of like Jim Jones and drinking the Kool-Aid of, you know, this one world vision. You know, if I could teach the world to smoke, do coke, you know.
You know that, gospel.
You know his bring to in his tarot reading in the bottom right corner of the Celtic cross, you know, is the world, which is, I found really interesting because that's the covenant. So it's a circumcision. He's Dick. Like, and he gets the reading from Don's wife, you know, and it's like then the Golden Dawn, you know, I mean, eventually they made their own deck, but they were a writer. They utilized the writer deck. They didn't use Marseille Tarot. They didn't use, you know, there was Crowley hadn't made his deck yet. So it's just, it's interesting. It's like it's golden. It's Dawn sitting there getting a Golden Dawn reading, and his bring to is the covenant. I don't know if you guys...
Wait, so you're saying that the arrangement that they use is a Golden Dawn arrangement?
No, I'm saying that the Golden Dawn utilized the Rider deck before they made their own deck. And their deck itself, you can just see it's very much just... more of a variation on the Rider deck than anything else. I just pointed it out, you know, that like... And then every episode ends with a Rider, you know, Sun card. But... I don't know. I thought that was interesting that his bring to would be the circumcision covenant Because that's what's being required of him the whole show. That's what's requested. Like, that's the implication when the Scarlet Woman names him Dick in the first place, you know? I mean, that's what I gathered from it anyway.
I mean, give us a tip, Dick.
And the Superman thing, huge. And I relate that right away. My mind is just all Ubermesh, 2001, New York City, Hilton. Like, I just go, you know, Emerald City, bam, you know.
What's his kryptonite?
Boy, what is his kryptonite? Good question.
Money? Money. No, the more money he makes, the more miserable he becomes.
Oh, there you go. It kills it. Yeah, okay. That's interesting.
Is it money or is it alcohol? I mean...
It's all of it.
Lack of freedom. Anytime...
What do you want me to say?
Oh, you know, well, you know what I
mean? What do you want me to say?
Waffle waitresses.
How many times does fucking Don Draper say, what do you want me to say in Mad Men?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to make a fucking YouTube video of just, what do you want me to say? What do you want me to say? What do you want me to say? Which is like he's a puppet.
That's what an advertisement asks the people. They go, what do you want me to tell you, right?
Yeah. What do you, not what is the truth, what is whatever. He says that over and fucking over again to the point that it was like, I'm like, how many times is this fucking guy going to ask? And then I realized what was being communicated by that. And it took him saying it all those times, which was just ridiculous. But I got to meditate on that point because he's not interested. That's the shift that happens for him. He goes from a place of just wanting to tell people what they want to hear to actually saying what needs to be said. And that is all in tied in with his identity, which is like you could take it as a metaphor for the advertising industry in the first place, that they have like a substitute identity, you know.
Have you ever read, oh, shoot, I lost it. It's Stephen King's something Atlantis. What is the book called? I mean, the book begins with the epigram from Easy Rider where we blew it.
Right. I don't know the book, but
Hearts in Atlantis. Hearts in Atlantis.
Oh yeah, that's it's the one with that has the shadow men.
Yeah, and the yellow coats or something.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. Stephen King is actually really good. It's just he's kind of got a juvenile tone. But
it seems like because that ties into his whole Dark Tower world, and that's definitely something I think about a lot in this story, that Don Draper is like the gunslinger in the Dark Tower, in that he goes through all of this to fight to win a very small victory. He goes through like six books to eventually show up at the beginning of the first book. Sorry, spoiler alert. You know,
this whole show is a fucking spoiler for anyone who hasn't seen Mad Men.
Yeah, but they didn't know they were going to get the Dark Tower and Risky Business spoiled for them too.
Right. Man, I can't watch anything anymore. I just if you listen to our show,
media since 2000.
Can someone ruin Aquarius? What's that final episode?
I heard that somebody dies at the end.
It does. Well, the thing is, I'll tell you the spoiler alert on this is by the end of the first season, Manson's still a long way. Like he's still just he's a villain. He's like that the cops are after on all these other levels. And, you know, they're setting him up as a freaky, abusive creep. And
is there a Manson conspiracy theory yet that he was really the good guy?
No.
I don't think he was ever the good guy,
that theory. But not good guy. He was in prison most of his life. He's a fucking criminal.
A patsy. He's like a Lee Harvey Oswald. He's not a good guy. He's just.
Yeah, but there's no proof that he ever told anybody to kill anybody. And that's, other than Susan Atkins' word, you know. And all the stuff, the Helter Skelter stuff, came from Susan Atkins for the most part. I mean, I don't know. Patrick might know something I don't. But, like, there's more evidence for him being a. The very thing that he's being accused of. He's the only person I know of that's ever been tried for. And found guilty for mind control. So they're literally the implication of his case is that he manipulated these people to do this, even though he never outright said, do this. The weird thing is that, like, there's all this evidence that he was himself manipulated by various, you know, I don't know, but apparently the prison that was, like, the cell block that was the number one cell block in the entire country that MK Ultra programming was experimented on happened on his cell block during the time he was there, before, long before the murders ever happened. Once again, correlation doesn't equal causation, but that is a very curious point. You could go on with the other sides to that whole deal for days. Doesn't mean he's a good fucking person, and that's the difficulty, I think, that a lot of people have. They're like, oh, are you fucking speaking for, like, are you defending Charles Manson? It's like, no, it's not a matter of that. It's like, but the way that it's set up, the charge that's on it leaves very little room to consider the different aspects because of that, you know. There's so much reactivity up around it. I mean, I've tried to talk to people about 9/11, you know, and just gotten really, like, it's so heavy. It's just, there's so much there. It's like, that feels like that's part of the programming. I mean, that was an advertisement that got
them
that way, you know. It's how the tragedy was presented, you know. And you look at the kind of work that the fucking Greeks did during Dionysian days to approach tragedy in such a way where they didn't have to have this, you know, they would allow a different relationship to tragedy so that they could understand it. That's something I think is lacking in our culture today, personally.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the quick to throw stones. I think that's the piece that is freaky about Aquarius, is it's setting up, in the same way that Mad Men did, but, and I think in a much more nefarious way, it's setting up, like, a kind of villain that we need to be always on the lookout for. And what, you know, what he looks like is, he's a guy who is connected to psychedelics and prostitutes, who has, you know, sort of messianic delusions of grandeur, sees himself as connected to the Christ archetype, and he has long hair, and he, you know, he looks groovy on the outside, but inside he's a pusher and a pimp. He's Charles Manson.
He's a shithead.
I can't even fucking, like, it's funny. It was challenging
and
for me to watch.
The guy who's going after him is the X-Files guy. That's the other, David, it's very much David Duchovny in Aquarius. And
okay.
It's very much his show.
I gotta
say
something here.
They make Manson an attractive looking dude.
What?
Yeah.
That actor, like, an attractive dude.
Manson, the Manson guy, yeah.
I need for Patrick, you keep writing things that are extremely applicable to what we're talking about in the messages. You need to speak over us, motherfuckers, and say that shit, because everything you've written is, like, really interesting, and I want to, and for our listen, if people who are listening to this, all five people or whatever, you know, they need to hear what it is that you're writing, because it's significant.
Yeah, what's up with that, Pat?
Welcome to Esalen, Patrick.
Yeah. I'm not a social bulldozer like you guys.
Well, be the rich story to our social bulldozer. Oh,
two words, Patrick. Drink more.
Yeah. I just wanted to say the actor that plays Manson on Aquarius shares a birthday with John Lennon. I just thought that was interesting.
Fuck yeah, that's interesting, dude. Totally.
Yeah.
Like, they probably had a room full of, like, 60 good-looking dudes, and they're like, give us the one with the Lennon birthday. There's gotta be, like, 60 of those guys.
What was the thing with Jared Leto, Lindsay Lohan? Tell me, Patrick. I can't remember.
Well, Jared Leto played Mark David Chapman in Chapter 27. And that same year, Lindsay Lohan, who was in Chapter 27, she played a character named Dakota in I Know Who Killed Me. And I played those movies together at the same time. And she says, I Know Who Killed Me, right when Lennon meets Chapman.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
When... that sounds like that's like almost ripe for a Rodney Asher style documentary.
Oh, dude, we're on it, dude.
We're living it, bro.
No, no, really.
That's what I'm saying, though.
This is our plan, dude. We got like, I don't know when the last time you looked at Patrick's blog, but holy fucking cow, dude. There's so much. It's just, there's so much potential there. It's ridiculous.
The Sync blog has gone extinct.
It really
in
has.
Our circle.
Why is that?
Things become, I think. That the blog started because it was like the 1.0 version of mass communication, like self-publishing. And then as we started interacting in a more human way, then things are evolving to more like the video audio stuff.
Well, I still look at blogs.
It's also Napster's revenge. Follow me with this. With Napster, everyone in America basically downloaded $40,000 worth of music if they wanted it. They got every album by every artist ever made, right? Like, we just raped the artist without even any guilt, right? People still download albums for free. We don't give a shit. We just steal. We steal.
I had guilt.
Well, I'm just saying the sync blog stuff, 20 years from now, they'll look back at those sync blogs and go, these idiots gave Hollywood enough ideas for the next 30 years. You're going to see threads from these sync blogs become storylines in movies, TV shows, and it was because scriptwriters who didn't have anything left in the tank, it's like this weird universal balance. Like, we stole all this stuff from artists, and then we gave the anti-artists all the ideas, and they're going to turn it on us.
Like Alan Squares the Touch, huh? When Fox took his fucking image, in all likelihood. Seems pretty... I mean, come on. I mean, you know what I'm talking about.
That show with Kiefer Sutherland, where the kid's named Jake. Give me a break. It was all about synchronicity.
Yeah, they like took...
The kid's name was Jake.
Right.
And he was
hey, you guys, I gotta go. All these... Hollywood's calling. I got a whole bunch of shows to create eight out of this. thanks a lot.
Cool.
You've been mind-raped. So,
uh-oh, careful.
Luck. Give
don't
my best
that
to Philip K. Dick.
Facebook.
Well, you
hey,
don't,
where,
you don't
when
post
can we find
Facebook.
Radio 8-Ball next, man?
We're going to be releasing the show. Alan and I are cutting together the show from August 8th of last year, and the first episode of that is going to be available on August 8th of this year, 1 year from the Sync Summit. And a lot of crazy things have happened in the interim, and it's going to be the context is going to be amazing.
One serious question. If Pepsi Cola came to you and said, we'll give you $10 million for the Radio 8 Ball idea, would you say yes?
I would definitely be in the conversation with them. I built as long as you don't fuck with the synchronicity, as long as the integrity of the synchronicity is there, I built it to be something that could be hoard without breaking its core in a
so
way
it could
that
be
I
swallowed up. It could be swallowed up like SCP was by McCann Erickson.
I don't know that they were the good guys.
They
were just a tool of the Empire. When you fight the Empire, you become the Empire.
Exactly.
What I'll say to this, there are things that I don't think could survive that, and there are things that I think could. It's sort of in the same way that, you know, Kubrick could have never gotten into bed with the business entities, you know, but he eventually figured out a way to work in the system so that what he was able to put on screen was able to speak through it. His was his monumental genius and his acumen as a, you know, as a photographer. When done in the context of Radio 8 Ball, I don't care whose name you slap on it. Synchronicity is bigger than any brand. And with that, there are deviled eggs that are calling my name. So, good luck. Thanks for having me on the call. And stay mad, man.
Adios.
Have you guys seen a show called Black Mirror?
No.
It's like a Twilight Zone?
It's like a Twilight Zone, yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, a couple of them.
Do you see White Christmas, the last one with Don Draper?
It was excellent. Refresh my memory about it.
I don't want to spoil it. I know we're spoiling the shit out of everything.
Oh, we've
and
all
whatever,
seen it all.
But, like, no, it's and I don't even know what justice I would give it.
Did you
like,
see that? I'm going to interrupt you. John Hamm is in another show called, like, The Doctor's Notebook or something. But his alter ego in the show is Harry Potter, or Daniel Radcliffe.
Hmm.
Who's also playing an orphan. But they are such different characters. Like, Daniel Radcliffe is 5'4", and John Hamm is, like, 5 or 6 something. Right, they're just so different. But then the idea that they're both like orphans.
Yeah, no, I dig it, dude. I hear you. Yeah, there's actually some synchronicity around the Larry David movie that he co-starred in. I don't know if you guys saw that. Can't remember what it's called, but I watched it a while ago. At this point, I don't have my notes on it, but yeah, there was some synchy shit in there for sure.
Larry David movie?
Yeah. It's a Larry David movie that's like a Curb Your Enthusiasm movie. And his co-star is fucking, what did you say, John Hamm? Is that his name?
Yeah, Dick, I think so.
Dick Draper.
But so Black Mirror, it's a TV show.
Yeah, there's just, you know, you have Black Christmas was the Keira DeLay, who's David Bowman, you know, and you can see Jake Coates' Synchmas video pointed out some really epic synchronicities involving that. Black Mirror is just loaded to the brim with Kubrick references. The thing in the first place seems to just straight up be a reference to the monolith, as far as I can tell. And so to have, you know, I watch Mad Men, I see the Babylon working all over the shit. I mean, that's how what I see. I mean, I can't, you know, whatever. I could be projecting. I'm sure in many cases I am. Certain parts just feel like too much, like it's ridiculous. And so watching Black Mirror, they play on the exact same theme, and particularly the episode with him was really something. But the reason why I thought of it in the first place was actually just because that idea of a show being hijacked, where there's a character, I forget what episode it was, there's only like one season, right? Or two seasons, and there's only like 5 episodes a season or less, I can't remember. But there's like a cartoon character that's like a political pundit or whatever, and he gets hijacked by the man, basically. It was like somebody came up, it was an interesting statement about how people can steal other people's you know, creative children, so
oh,
to speak.
Oh, I started watching that. You're right.
What's that? I'm right about what?
Yeah, I started watching this show, too.
I'm right in what way? I'm
think you
curious.
Said everyone's seen this. You're not going to spoil anything. It's not. Was there a larger story arc that it was telling, or was it episodic?
What's that? Was it a larger story or episodic?
Was there a narrative?
Is there breathing happening? I hear like heavy breathing. Is there somebody getting off on this conversation right now?
Yeah. My baby.
Your baby. Really? That's sweet. You're holding a baby right now?
There's a toy in the other room that it's the Sesame Street car.
Oh.
Okay. I'm sorry. So Black Mirror, is there a larger story arc, or is it just...
Oh, throughout the whole thing?
Yeah.
Oh, well, there's a definite theme that runs throughout that deals with all the themes that Kubrick dealt with. So you have this artificial intelligence thing going on. You have kind of like the pyramidal structure. It's a point on technology becoming... like, how far can you go where something takes on human characteristics but doesn't have a soul? And what are the repercussions of us relating to it as if it did? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's the main thing that I drew from it. But there's a lot there. It's just very like poignant social, metaphysical issues, and just goes to town on it in a similar way that the Twilight Zone did. It's like the Twilight Zone if Kubrick had made the Twilight Zone, which is a very high compliment as far as I'm concerned. I thought it was a fantastic show. I loved it. I just wish there was more episodes. I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. All right, you guys.
Yeah, I think so.
Is this...
Can we do a round of closing comments?
Sure. What you got, Bill?
Oh, I just wanted to bring up... I was taking notes, you know, obviously, when we were doing this. And I imagine other people were, too. And I just picking one out of the bunch that I did. I'll let someone else go first. Or we just end the call. I don't know.
What, you got some fucking notes? Share your notes, dude.
I can't read them right now.
All right, so let me talk about Jesus.
Oh, boy, I knew this was going to come up sooner or later. Okay. I knew what
the
show was
going to be. I've been reading, really slowly reading this book called Fields of Blood.
The Bible?
No, Fields of Blood, but it starts in the Bible. And so her thesis is that the system, the empire that we know, the state, the all-controlling state, kind of began with large-scale agriculture that we needed to... So it's weird because I've been really trying to figure out, like, one of the things that I do is we're in this culture, we're in this society, and it's not fair, and there are elements of it that are really nasty, but we benefit from it because we're at the apex of this pyramid. You know, where we're at, our position in, you know, like, we have the prime real estate on the Death Star. We're in a good spot, but at the same time, we need a cognitive dissonance because there's this guilt or the gnawing, like the emptiness that we feel because it's just empty consumption. That we are to be able to do what we do, people have to be exploited.
Right.
And so then the idea of that divine invasion, like how is the system undone or can it be undone? And it's interesting because a figure like Jesus was someone who was going against empire, and then his message was actually subverted by Paul to try and retrofit it so that it would fit in the empire because he was, you know, all right, his teachings are good, but this stuff that opposes the empire, that's not going to work. We're going to have to be flexible.
Yeah.
I don't know. So, Will and I are talking next week. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think, as I do, that the empire was swallowed up by the internet, or at least right now the internet is the snake, and the empire is like the big egg in its mouth that is half, you know, he's stretching his mouth around it? Because that's what I see that has happened.
Well, that's a salvia vision. Thanks for that one. You can give me nightmares, dude.
So yeah, the empire, the Black Iron Prison, is being swallowed up by the internet. And I thought it was interesting that you mentioned Divine Invasion, because that was the book that I was going to bring up in my closing note. Was that if a rabbi read Divine Invasion in 1981, he would see, you go, oh my God, this author understands, you know, all these things that I study, right? Like what one man called science fiction, I call Judaism, you know, this struggle, this whole cosmic interplay, you know. So a rabbi would see that immediately in Philip K. Dick's work in a way where Philip K. Dick might not know as concretely as the rabbi assumes him to know, right? Because this artwork flowed out of him. So I think that we watch Mad Men sort of like these, shit, you know, I'm almost 40 and I've been studying this stuff. I'm not a great rabbi, but I'm not the worst. I watch Mad Men through this sort of sync rabbinical lens and I go, holy God, this guy sees, you know, the thing. But maybe we see things for Matthew Weiner that he can't see for himself. because this art is flowing through him. I just feel that that this is a show that is so complicated and so layered that it captures this time and space so well that when my niece turns 40 and she watches Mad Men, she'll go through the same thing and see the, sort of the, some of the same things that I did. Whether or not she catches it, what we talk about here, I don't know, but it's there for her. That's all I got.
There's actually a famous Kabbalistic story where Moses somehow magically in the future, future being like 12th century or something, I don't know, but he's talking to a Kabbalist. And the Kabbalist is telling him all this shit about the gematria of this and all that. He's all like, oh, the 216-letter name with the 72 triplets and all this stuff and six times six, whatever. And he's asking him all this stuff, and Moses is just kind of standing there, and he's like, well, what did you mean for this? And Moses goes, no, but that's amazing. It's like, and it adds to it. He's like, no, that's totally, I mean, that's the point, but no, I didn't, you know. Wow, I hadn't thought of that, you know. And so I think, that's at least how it was translated to me. I mean, I haven't read the text, you know, but that, and I don't know. I think that there's something to be said. I think Mr. Wiener, if you presented this stuff to him, he would either think you're a wacko or he might go, far out, I hadn't thought of that. Interesting.
Well, that's what Kubrick did, right? He just sat back and let all the weirdos tell him what his movie was about.
Right, and then circle the shit about the fucking pink hue behind the monolith or whatever, and, you know, like, exclamation point, yeah.
But he never told those people, get a life. He just listened.
It's true. But he let them chop off their nipples and freak out, not being able to decipher the indecipherable.
Yeah, that's kind of harsh.
Does our culture make us unhappy? Or is the human condition just a state of emptiness? Or are we a product of the political system that we're in? Like, does Mad Men address those things? Can those things be addressed? Is there an answer for it? Because, like, when Matthew Weiner, when he was working on Becker, I was listening to, I think it was a Fresh Air or something, he's explaining how he's at the pinnacle of his life. He has everything. He's got a wife. He's doing his own show. He should be happy, and he wasn't happy. Why? And so he wanted to explore that, so he created Don Draper, who should be happy. He's got a beautiful wife. She was a model. And so he starts cheating with the bohemian, and he says, you know, I don't know if you have everything or if you have nothing.
What happens in a meadow at dusk?
Well, it's the same character as Tony Soprano. Soprano is a crime lord. He's the boss of an operation. He's got all the money he wants. He's got all the food and drugs he wants, but he's not happy. He's having panic attacks. He's like, what's the deal? I figured this out. I've got everything I'm supposed to have. Why am I not happy? And he has to go to therapy and dig that shit out. Draper is, he's not as occluded as Soprano. He knows exactly why he's unhappy. He's able to compartmentalize it, I think, a lot more than Tony Soprano did. But, you know, it's same thing, right?
Can one be happy?
Absolutely.
Look at the thigh and
those guys
and smile.
Just twirl around and dance and eat grapes.
I don't know. The Sufis are happy. Oh, the Sufis are totally happy. I got locked in a room one night with them all night in India, in Delhi, and they just played music all night. Complete, consistent ecstasy. Completely natural. All night long. No break. Just play, dance. I have never seen anybody that, I mean, I've been to a million raves, and I've never seen so much authentic happiness in my life from what I saw from the Sufis, really.
I think there's a point in time in my life where I wouldn't believe that story, but I completely believe you.
No, it's my teacher, Baba Hari Das, at the time, you know, they presented it like it was going to be this short thing, And he literally sat all night, and he never got up to go to the bathroom. We asked him about it afterwards, what it was like for him, and he said it was like pulling teeth. But really? it wasn't because he didn't like the music, and it wasn't because he didn't love the people. It was because when you're considered a guru, you're like not allowed to like get up and do anything. He's like, I have to sit here now. It was a trap. They basically trapped him, and they didn't tell him that it was going to be all night. And then once it gets going, they just didn't stop. And then because of the devotional nature of it, we couldn't ask them to stop. So it's like, I don't know.
So if they ever elect like a Sufi politician, his filibuster, he'll just play music and dance for 12 and a half hours.
As part of his argument. Totally.
Is Don's emptiness a product of capitalism or just his modern existential crisis, or our modern existential crisis?
What's the difference? I mean, this is a thing. If you look at Norman O'Brown's Life Against Death, when he's talking about capitalism, he literally makes a statement that, first of all, that idea from Jung's disciple, who was Jung's patient, who ended up becoming a psychoanalyst, right? When she said that the death instinct and the pleasure principle are mutually interdependent. That book makes the argument that, yes, they are mutually, well, it doesn't say yes, absolutely, but it's considering, not only are they considered mutually interdependent, but they are the basis for capitalism. So that the movement towards pleasure and the pursuit of happiness is at the same time a movement towards its own destruction, because the thing is basically a giant dick. So it's all moving towards climax, you know. We're existing within the sex drive, which is the basis for, you know, Dr. Strangelove, admittedly, that you're looking at the rising tensions between America and Russia being like, you know, kill the father, fuck the mother, you know, Mother Russia. But it's like that, you know, movement towards orgasm is also a movement towards destruction. It gets replicated in that way, which... Personally, I feel like there's no more direct metaphor that I can find other than the cleat boat in that regard, because it's something that has an appeal that also is destructive. And so I see Dawn's whole trip as like the Golden Dawn's trip. Like that's a movement towards perfection or pleasure or success is also a movement towards destruction, but out of that destruction comes something else, and this is the Gagal, this is the spiral that we're always moving through. And that's why it's appropriate to relive the 60s and to transpose it onto that period in which Mad Men was playing, because you could easily see that as the Gagal. It's a infinite winding or whatever. Creation, destruction.
In season 7, he opens up by reading the Inferno, right, by Dante, the Divine Comedy. So, you know, the beginning is the main thing that they're trying to sell is tobacco, which is fire, right?
And right, like strike.
Coke, which is water. So he goes from fire to water. He goes from Inferno to Purgatory, right?
Right, but it's a substitute water. It's carbonated. It's like the false thing. It's all about the replication of the actual empire.
So like, that's the false nature of the waters of our planet, if you only had the waters above the firmament, right? So purgatory is our planet. That's all he's trying to say. It's an old story. It's just a new way of saying it, right?
Sure. Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that both those things are substitutes. So the cigarettes, you know, you suck on a cigarette, it's basically like a nipple or the devil's little white dick, I guess. But, you know, Lucky Strike, I mean, I don't know, I see that as like a replication of a natural process. Just like in Full Metal Jacket, you know, when they're where is it going to go with that?
Well, I was going to say quickly, I look over at my desk right now and I have an electronic cigarette, right? It's called Blue, and it's got a little blue triangle pointing down, right? So this is the cigarette has gone from fire to water vapor.
Right. Okay.
About chemical transformation, right?
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say is that they replaced the men's sex drive with a drive to kill. Right. So they're in the prime of their youth, right, in Full Metal Jacket, and then they're going to get some. I mean, they're going to get a kill. So you take the thing. It's just like, I find it really interesting. You know, you look at a six shooter revolver, you know, you're looking at the template of Metatron. Like, this is a destructive weapon that's basically imitating a dick. And then it's like, well, this is something that would be used for creation, but in this case, it's used for destruction. I mean, the four main death sentences back in the day in the Judea or whatever. I mean, they were meant to replicate the Tetragrammaton. They were the reversal of Tetragrammaton or the Black Mirror. And so that's really kind of an interesting little premise there when you're looking at what everything that they're advertising in Mad Men seems to be like substitute for something that would be natural and selling it to people, even though they already have the thing that it's replicating. Like, they own the goods. They are the goods.
They substituted our instinct to fuck with our instinct to buy.
Yeah. You had a confirmation, Patrick, you had a number of them, but the thing with Pasadena, when they go to Pasadena and there's the missile shit, we had a whole Jack Parsons connection, because they go to JPL, don't they?
They go to an Astro, North American Aviation Conference in Pasadena. And Jet Propulsion Labs is one of the organizations that was there.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they watched that video on nuclear warheads and genetically engineered humans designed for space travel.
Yeah, which is so weird, right? I mean, because this is you're already like, is this suggesting the Babylon working? It seems to like, is this all this stuff going on?
And that's right when he meets Conrad Hilton.
Right.
And I think that was, yeah, that was when they conceived Baby Jean.
Mm-hmm.
And who Sally was tripping out on as a replacement of Grandpa Jean.
Right.
David, give me the 3-sentence description of the Babylon working.
How do we spread the philosophy of Thelema as widespread as you can get? What's the means to kind of like blanket the populace through subversive means to perpetuate this understanding?
Okay, and they utilized an Enochian air tablet in the rituals for the Babylon working, right?
From my understanding, it was all the watchtowers were involved, which is a kind of a complex deal. They're taking it's. So if you want to make a golem, you literally take the letters and you form them into a circle, and it's like a combination lock. So you're literally in your mind, your visualization is so acute that you're able to be like this letter in relationship to this letter, in relationship to this letter, in relationship to this letter, and move around in a circle and create geometrical patterns that not like that you're so involved in. It's not like a conceptual thing. It's like an ecstatic thing. So that something is literally born into creation is the premise. So that there's that, you know, that goes way back. That's an old idea. And there's way more to it than that. That's a huge oversimplification of the matter. But just to understand that principle, it's like if you were looking at the cover of Ram Dass's Be Here Now with the chair. Oh, or I'm looking at it right now on the fucking SyncBook Radio image. This thing that we use for SyncBook Radio behind, that geometrical design, is the tool used to create a golem. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah. So we have the golem symbol literally as our SyncBook fucking press thing. Trips me out. And then it's like he's holding like what? It's like a wafer. It looks like a I don't know, some kind of, yeah, is it a sacrament? Does he have the freaking you know, I don't know. But yeah, no, there's a lot to it, and it's so shrouded. We don't exactly know what L. Ron Hubbard and Jack Parsons were up to necessarily.
Well, it's amazing that they utilized an Enochian air tablet in some of their magical workings, right? And nowadays, there's a good chance that one of us during this call is utilizing Skype on a iPhone Air tablet.
That's funny.
I am.
It's true. So now here's the thing. This is how it gets creepy, man. So the whole thing, if you would capsulize, was basically make the message of Salema a global thing. What would be the best? How would be the – if you could – the easiest way to do that in the 50s would be to put it in the Bible. Anytime you saw a Bible, if you opened it up, there'd be a pamphlet inside that spread the message of Salema. If you could pull that off, I mean, you would convert. If you converted 0.1% of those people, you got yourselves an army.
Well, you know my argument.
But here's the deal. Someone owns the Bible on their smartphone. They read the Bible on their phone. You know what? Salema is one link away on the air tablet.
It's just a link away. Well, it's just a link away.
It's a hyperdimensional language machine, which is what an Enochian language square is based on the technology they had 400 years ago.
Right.
You put Salema in the Bible. It's right there in front of us, in our hand. That's how you spread the message of Salema. You let it get swallowed up into the same entity as the Bible.
Right.
This shit is simple science, right?
Well, my theory is that the golem is actually disembodied in the sense that I feel that it's actually a chemical. And so I have my own trip on it, and I'd never, like, it's not I wouldn't assert this. Like, this is the fucking thing. I'm not like Jay Widener with the Kubrick movie, you know? Like, I don't know that, but, like, I relate to it as if that's, even if it's beyond their knowledge, like, they're doing this thing, and I see a direct relationship between splitting the atom, LSD being, like, the corollary or whatever. But I see LSD as the prophet of Thelema, and that's the application of the Moonchild, is that the Moonchild is literally the substance. But that's my own trip. I don't expect anyone else to buy into it. I don't even know if I completely buy into it myself. It's just all the signs seem to point to that for me.
I think it was radio.
I think the Moonchild was radio.
Absolutely.
Radio's been around long before the
Every physician thinks that they brought the Moonchild, right?
Right. I mean, I don't know. I just, yeah.
Everyone does their part, but, you know, no one really knows who brings the Moonchild. We just know it's here.
Well, it's the Empress in The NeverEnding Story, right? Didn't she bring the Moonchild?
I think she brings a couple.
Theodore.
Just because Parsons and those dudes were doing the Moonchild ritual, the fact that they were doing that was just, they were bored when they were getting high, you know what I mean? It was just a new game to play. They had pretty serious lives outside of that shit. I mean, Parsons, you talk about trying to summon a Moonchild, his technology send people to the moon. I mean, how literal can you get?
Did it?
It's stupid.
Did it?
Have you seen Tom Hanks from the Earth to the Moon?
I was just thinking as I was saying that Apollo 13, because I was visualizing Danny walking in the hallway in his Apollo sweater, and then I was like, Apollo 13. There's a snake in my boot. Anyways, no, I've never seen that show. Have you?
I have, but it was before all this. It was like the thing that really captured my attention in my early synchromysticism career. So I was captivated by the moon because I was trying to figure out. So Joseph Campbell said that the hero needs to be connected to the land, that there has to be these identifiable trade or landmarks so that the people are rooted into their mythology.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, he was saying that we need a world mythology. Like, that's what's lacking now, is that the idea of a hero that speaks to everyone.
And right.
I couldn't figure out any, like, what landmark do we have to sink into other than like the moon. Like,
right.
And so I just really became captivated by the moon, and I, of course, entered into the whole conspiracy also.
What about the Higgs boson? That was the new moon for a while.
Oh, yeah.
The what's that?
The Higgs boson.
Ah.
But you know what? What's fucking weird is that... Did I say the F word too much? I do, don't I? I'm sorry, guys. I just... it's my grandfather coming out of me. That Forrest Gump, which is funny because it reminds me of the Gump in Legend, who was in the forest. He's a Gump. He's a Forrest Gump. Anyways, that in the book, Forrest Gump, he goes to the moon, right? He goes into space, and then he lands on a desert island, or he crashes in the ocean, ends up on a desert island. I don't know if you guys ever looked at it.
There's a book?
Yeah, the book of Forrest Gump before the movie came out. He also did a Vietnam book called Better Times Than These, which I actually read when I was young. But I find it really funny that in the book Forrest Gump, he does these things that he ended up doing in these other movies, like Island, you know, or whatever. Or Stranded? Stranded? Is that what it's called?
Castaway.
Yeah.
Castaway, thank you. Island, Stranded, Castaway, yeah. Anyways, he was a castaway in the book Forrest Gump, and then he also went to space. So it was just, I don't know, I was like, huh, weird. I don't completely know where I'm going with that. And I probably moved it off topic from what you were trying to
say. You know what's weird? I remember I tell people I haven't seen the movie Forrest Gump, they look at me like I'm crazy.
I must have had about 15 Dr. Peppers. And you know that 15 is the number of the devil card in tarot, and that the devil's pepper in Rosemary's Baby, and it's an obvious correlation there somehow. Sergeant Pepper, devil's pepper, Dr. Pepper.
I'm a pepper.
23 saying. Special herbs and secret spices. I don't know what they say.
I don't know.
It's time to move along, I think.
Oh, so now you're the host of Always Record.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry.
Sorry, guys. Well, I just want to say it's been lovely having you.
All right. Now, since this is all about advertising, David, send us off with a great Sync Book Plus advertisement.
No, you're so much better, dude. I mean it. You have the radio voice.
Buy our shit,
for Christ's sake. We're struggling artists.
I think everything good starts that way.
Mm.
That when I was reading about Twin Peaks, they weren't making any money when they were doing that pilot. They didn't. They were just trying to get through the day. Mm. I don't know. Maybe it'll happen.
I don't know. I can tell you.
I want to see that documentary that you and Patrick are going to make.
We're going to make something, but it's a little bit like Brian's book. That's what I was relating to it.
Family Guy, yeah.
Family Guy, because I keep... It's like, oh, so how's that book going? It's been a couple of years now. You know, it's got a lot of character development, a lot of, some people learn things. I'm learning some things, right? You know, anyways, yeah, I'm it's coming along. We're gathering information endlessly. But as we do so, as we open up ourselves to a wide array of a ton of information, every so often, you know, there's these pieces that I just want to drop all in a row, which is the value of having a think tank operation like this, is that, like, you wouldn't get to those big unexplainable things if you didn't open yourself up to all the fucking random shit that may or may not mean anything. Mm-hmm. We're you know, creating a resource. And so it's things are coming together. I'm feeling good about it. There will be a documentary at some point of some nature. That's my feeling. You feel the same, Patrick? I mean,
yep. A Rolling Stone gathers no Elizabeth Moss.
That's a little bit too Glenn Close for comfort. Anyways, you guys, it's been lovely. Been grand.
Yeah.
You should actually. We got a fucking Always Record host on the line right now. Besides myself, Bill the Lizard.
Oh, ex-host.
What do you got on your horizon? What you doing this summer, Bill?
Some are working, two jobs, bartending, trying to get back into school, take some math classes. I'm going to go back and teach high school math. That's the plan now.
Nice.
Other than that, just enjoying the summer weather, man. It's nice out there. Going to take a walk after this call. So.
Nice.
Yeah. Got good herb flowing around the area right now, and that always helps.
Cool. Patrick,
yeah.
Your fucking blog, dude. I don't know how many people realize what's going on over at that place, but Patrick is fucking laying down the meat of the biscuit for the world. He's laying it down for all to see.
What's that blog address?
Overlap Hotel at blogspot.com.
Gonna go there right now.
You should go there. I recommend to anybody to go there.
I'm currently working on an epic Mad Men post that I hope to finish by the end of the month. It lays out all the like Babylon working sinks and all that kind of stuff. A lot of stuff that I didn't get to here because, one, it's too much to go over in one episode. And
wait,
two,
have you listened to Always Record? You got 5 hours.
Yeah.
Still not enough.
Well, yeah. We've been going for 3.
Right. Still not enough. I mean, really. And it's like, I don't have my notes, you know? It's like, there's... yeah. And also, I've been contributing. Patrick and I are working on a Heather O'Rourke post that'll come out in the not-too-distant future. But yeah, that's pretty meaty, too. Mm-hmm. So, yep.
That stuff is too much, man.
Enough is enough, but how much is too much? So...
cool.
All right, you guys. It's been grand.
Layla.
It was fun. I think there's a lot of density on this show. I think the first 42 minutes is going to be interesting.
Yeah, and just like Mad Men, we're ending it with the Crown and Conquering Child, who you can hear in the background, Doug's house.
Oh, he's going to be cut out.
Oh, really? Leave it in so you can get the reference, man. Leave this in, too, of me telling you to leave it in. Yeah!
All right. Sun cards. Sun cards to you all.
Okay, my friend.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com. We'll be right back.
Once there was a way to get back homeward. Once there was a way to get back home. Sleep, pretty darling, do not cry, and I will sing a lullaby. Sing a lullaby. Once there was a way to get back homeward. Once there was a way to get back home. Sleep, pretty darling, do not cry, and I will sing a lullaby.